It's Wednesday, September 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, Hungary closes its borders as migrants and refugees become stranded. We go there to learn more.
Republicans have been advocating a much more muscular U.S. response to the crisis in Syria.
U.S. lawmakers consider what to do about Syrian refugees. Also ahead, the United States might be exporting oil. Republican presidential hopefuls are about to debate each other. And Taylor Swift is singing again. It's all on today's International Edition. Hungary has sealed its border as it promised to crack down on illegal crossings by migrants and refugees. VOA's Ayesha Tanzim is on the scene, and she joins me by telephone with what she has witnessed during the past day.
I was at the Hungarian side of the border, mostly in the border villages of Reske and Moratalam, and trying to figure out whether Hungarian government is seriously implementing its policy of illegal border crossings and stopping them. And what I realized was that the government is indeed extremely serious. The police presence today in border towns was much heavier than what we have seen in the last few days. The army was also visibly present, although in a supporting role. And what we saw was that the same roads where we could see migrants, a steady stream of them walking by the side of the road, there was nobody there. There was a group of Afghan men that we saw in one town, Moratalam, and I asked them where they were coming from. They were confused, that they didn't know what to do, and that's almost a very common story here. A lot of people just don't know what to do and where to go, and they're just following each other. This side of Hungarian border, very heavy police presence. The other side of the Hungarian border, we could hear crowds gathering. We could hear them chanting, no food, no water, Germany, just open the door. They were asking our Arabic translator where to go, where the entry point was. But the government has made it very clear that apart from two entry points, one at Tampa and one at Rishke, both villages, no other place will be considered entry point for migrants. The confusion I have found is overwhelming. Most of the times, people just cannot get through to each other. The authorities here, the migrants speaking the Arabic, the authorities here speaking Hungarian, very few people speaking English. There's just confusion all around.
Did you get a sense that some migrants are actually getting through those two entry points?
I talked to the UN spokesperson, Babar Baloch, today, and he said that their information was that the registration process was on again, off again. So it was starting, then stopping, then resuming again. Nobody had a clear sense of how many people got through.
For those stuck on the Serbian side of the border and crying out for food and water, is there any indication that perhaps aid is coming their way while they're stuck?
Yes, the people who are at certain points on the Serbian side of the border, particularly on these border crossings that are closed, there was Red Cross there today, there was MSF, there was Save the Children, and there were some other local charities. Now, if people are coming through for some in-between points where trying to cross the fence through some other route, then I doubt that they have aid, and they're probably walking through the fields and picking and eating whatever they can find in the fields. We saw some migrants with grapes in their hands. Some migrants told us that they were just eating apples from the fields, because you do see some fruit and some vegetables in the fields around. There are corn fields around, but it's not exactly clear that there's any aid other than at certain points.
We greatly appreciate you sharing what you have seen today with us, and we wish you the safest of travels. Ayesha Tanzim, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Turning now to social media reactions on the ongoing refugee crisis, International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here in the studio to do just that. Hello, G, and please tell us about some of the hashtags that people are using.
Hi, Jim. I mentioned yesterday that hashtag Syrian refugees was used more often than both hashtag refugee crisis and hashtag migrant crisis combined. Now, in addition to those, there are a number of new hashtags people started using. And if you view the current situation as a refugee and not a migrant crisis, you'd be happy to see the hashtags.
So are these new hashtags more sympathetic to these people?
Exactly. It really reflects a changing sentiment in Europe toward the migrants and refugees. A case in point is hashtag refugees welcome. That hashtag was used in 14,000 tweets in the last 24 hours. But of course, there are always two sides to an issue. Hashtag refugees not welcome also exists, but it's not as popular. That hashtag was used in more than 700 tweets in the same time frame.
And anyone that you've been following closely today?
Well, I'm still following updates from our own reporters like Aisha Tanzim and Heather Murdoch, but outside of our team of reporters, I'm really enjoying updates from Melissa Fleming. She's the Chief Communications Officer and spokesperson for the UNHCR, and her handle is at Melissa R. Fleming. Her pinned tweet from July is a picture of a girl at a refugee camp in Iraqi Kurdistan. Now, along with a photo, Fleming wrote, "She looked to me like she was carrying the entire weight of the Syrian civil war on her small shoulders." More than 1,000 people shared that tweet and marked it as a favorite about 700 times.
How influential is her account?
Well, quite influential, I'd say, because she has nearly 30,000 followers and is pretty active on Twitter. Jim?
I should say. Well, helping to build her Twitter account is G. Abby Lee. Follow her, please, at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. senators of both major political parties are telling VOA that the United States must help address serious humanitarian crisis and the massive outpouring of migrants from that war-ravaged country. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman joins me by telephone. Michael, what have you been hearing?
Well, Jim, I spent several hours roaming the halls of the U.S. Capitol, speaking to various senators as I went, and I got a picture of Congress's thought process when it comes to this unfolding, heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching Syrian migrant crisis. The consensus seems to be that the United States can't sit by idly, that President Obama's announcement that the United States will take in 10,000 of these migrants is very much a step in the right direction, and that the United States does bear some responsibility to act. I should say that that's pretty much where the agreement ends. After that, you get into very partisan matters.
Are they wanting to take in more than this 10,000 figure that has been put out there?
Some believe that 10,000 is simply a drop in the bucket, that it is too little. Senator Tim Kaine, a Democrat from Virginia, told me that taking in migrants is a good first step, but that there should be even more done, that now it is time for the United States to work with the international community to set up a safe zone within northern Syria so that those fleeing the conflict in Syria don't have to leave the country entirely. I ran that idea past the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Republican Bob Corker, and he was thoroughly exasperated to hear that suggestion because, of course, he and other Republicans have been advocating a much more muscular U.S. response to the crisis in Syria. there's a lot of passion surrounding this issue.
Well, Michael Bowman, we thank you for roaming the halls of the Senate and finding out all the information for us.
Thank you, Jim.
The U.S. Congress, meanwhile, is considering lifting a ban on U.S. oil exports. We find out more from Alexis Christophorus, who joins me from our bureau in New York.
House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy says the House is preparing to vote later this month to repeal a 40-year-old ban on the export of crude oil. The plan was immediately celebrated by the oil industry, but it's already drawing fire from environmental groups. The oil industry has started a major lobbying campaign to generate support in Washington for the repeal of the ban. It was first imposed during the 1970s oil crisis, a legislative effort that will face tougher opposition in the Senate. The American Petroleum Institute has started an ad campaign pushing the proposed repeal. It argues that allowing oil exports would actually reduce the price of gasoline by creating an incentive for continued new oil production in the U.S. at a time when the domestic oil glut has sent prices tumbling. Several refiners oppose lifting the ban because they fear the action will raise the price of domestic oil. Meantime, the White House has made clear it does not support the House legislation, saying the Commerce Department already has the authority to make adjustments in the policy. Jim?
Well, investors also have on their minds what might happen at the upcoming Federal Reserve meeting that is planned. How the market's been reacting so far?
We actually saw a nice rally for U.S. stocks, with the S&P 500 closing at its highest level in more than 2 weeks, up 1.3% to 1,978. And that's after a strong retail sales report showed a resilient consumer. Meanwhile, a quarterly survey says chief executive officers of large U.S. companies are becoming less optimistic about the prospects for the world's largest economy. More leaders are planning to cut capital spending and employment in the next 6 months. Meantime, speculation has increased the Fed will delay raising rates as China ignited concern that its slowdown could weigh on global growth. While investors remain confident the central bank will increase borrowing costs this year, traders are pricing in just a 30% chance of action on Thursday. That is down from 48% before China's currency devaluation last month. Odds of a move at the December Fed meeting are 62%. Jim?
Never a delay for the latest economic news from Alexis Christophorus. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Republican White House hopefuls are set to debate at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in California today. VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone joins me in the studio. Jim, it's Donald Trump and Ben Carson leading in the polls so far.
They have something in common, along with Carly Fiorina, in that they are political outsiders. They're not professional politicians, and they seem to be driving the interest of voters right now. And, of course, we know that Trump has a lot of bluster. His style is bombastic and in your face. And not only is he not afraid to go on the attack, he's probably the quickest at being able to pivot and respond to an attack for anyone that we've seen in quite a while. Ben Carson's a completely different sort of candidate. He is quieter. He doesn't like to take the bait about getting into these internecine battles with other rivals in the race. But Carson, again, has this political newcomer, neophyte aspect to him that people seem to be interested in right now. They have had a little bit of back and forth. Carson made a comment about religion. Mm-hmm. Trump took that to as a shot at his own kind of religious past. And they seem to have kind of moved on from that. A lot of the folks expect that if there are going to be some fireworks in this second debate, it could be between Donald Trump and Carly Fiorina. Both have been competing for the mantle of sort of the business professional, the person who came from the business world to make an impact in politics. But they've been at each other for several months, and Trump is not shy about pointing out Fiorina's record at Hewlett-Packard, which, you know, is debatable. But there's a real potential for that to take off. And, of course, Fiorina is the only woman in the Republican field right now. Mm-hmm.
This is a rather large debate. A lot of candidates. How many candidates do we have?
This time it'll be 11 candidates. There were 10 in the first debate. So all 10 of those are returning, plus Fiorina, who basically made this debate because she shined in the earlier sort of lesser candidates debate. They're going to have another one of those ahead of the main debate at the Reagan Library. And this will involve four folks because former Virginia Governor Jim Gilmore wasn't able to make the cut. You had to have at least 1% in three national polls, and Gilmore wasn't able to do that. And Rick Perry will not be there, the former Texas governor, because he's dropped out of the race. So the focus will be on this second debate, 11 contenders. And all of them realize right now that Trump is kind of driving the race. And so how they calculate how best to alter that narrative, I think we'll start to see that play out in the debate.
Trump has basically taken all of the media attention. I know some of the cable networks are showing his speeches and rallies, and you just don't see that from the other candidates.
Not only that, I mean, these candidates generally, if you want to appear on programs on the networks or cable networks, you have to show up in a studio generally. You have to be in person. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is able to call into these programs on a whim, even on the Sunday news shows here in the States. The question is, what is the changes that are going to occur to change the trajectory of this race right now? We don't know, but it would seem the debates would be a logical starting point for someone to try to make an impact, whether they decide to go on the attack against Donald Trump or try something else. I think we're going to start to see that play out on Wednesday night.
Well, there's no debate that we get the best analysis from senior political correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Well, if you happen to be wondering why International Edition host Susan Yockey is speaking with music guru Larry London, it may be because they're both fans of arguably the hottest female pop singer today.
From our music division today, the hottest thing going in the biz, that would be Taylor Swift, of course. And I'm joined here in the studio by the host of our music program, Border Crossings, the famous Larry London. Welcome, Larry.
Well, thank you, Susan. Taylor Swift seems to continue to find ways to get in the mainstream and in the headlines, and whatever it is she's doing, for better or for worse. The latest bit of news about Taylor, there's a couple of things. First of all, congratulations to Taylor on getting 9 nominations.
Outstanding.
9 nominations for the MTV Europe Awards, which will be handed out in October in Milan, Italy. She just came off of a big win at the MTV Video Music Awards here in the U.S. She got the Video of the Year Award, and so now she's up for 9 in Europe. She was named the most popular person, the most followers on social media, with 46.5 million followers on Instagram and 63.5 million followers on Twitter. And her 1989 album is the best-selling album of the year so far. Her earnings this past year, $80 million this past year alone, just in this one year. Now she's got a new song.
You know, I bet
out.
She has a nice place.
I bet she's got a few nice places. A few, as a matter of fact. But her new song is called Wildest Dreams. And this features a different look at Taylor because now she's colored her hair black. And she's taken on the persona of a 1940s film star. A lot of people are connecting her to the look of Elizabeth Taylor in her new video, Wildest Dreams, which is great. It's a great song, and it's another hit off the 1989 album.
Say you'll remember me, standing in a nice dress, staring at the sunset, babe, red lips and rosy cheeks. Say you'll see me again, even if it's just in your wildest dreams. Wildest dreams.
You know, I think she's been hot since she first came onto the scene. I've really enjoyed her music. And one thing I like about her is she has not been raunchy. She hasn't made her fame based on raunchiness. She has real talent, real good look. She's a great dancer. And she's extremely successful.
Yes, she's a good role model, which the music industry has few of. And not only that, she's made the turn from country music to pop music with the new album. This is a very big change for her and her career. And it was a gamble. Her record company were not in favor of this move, but it's turned out successful.
And sometimes we see stars like this that you can see they're going to start to fade. You're going to see, ah, this fad's over with. She's out. But I don't see anywhere that she's dipping at all.
Yeah, she's managed to put her finger on the pulse of music no matter what she does. And, you know, the world is her oyster. Is that what they say?
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, she's got a big, bright future. She's about to head to Asia for her tour in the fall. So she's getting excited about that, going to China and other places throughout Asia. So it's been a great year for Taylor Swift, and we'll see what happens with the new song.
Well, thank you, Larry, for stopping by.
Thank you, Susan.
Been listening to International Edition. You can always find us at our website, voanews.com. There's no one better to direct our program than Tracy Carter. Thank you, Tracy. And our engineer du jour, the incomparable, Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In late December 2013, Egyptian security forces raided a hotel room that housed the makeshift remote studio of three journalists employed by the Qatar-based Al Jazeera News Network. The three journalists, Australian Peter Grest, Canadian Mohamed Fahmy, and Egyptian Bahar Mohamed, were arrested and charged with airing falsified footage intended to damage Egyptian national security, operating without a license, and supporting ousted President Mohamed Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood, a group considered to be a terrorist organization by the Egyptian government. The three men were tried and found guilty twice. In June of 2014, they were found guilty. Two were sentenced to 7 years imprisonment. One received a 10-year sentence. Citing lack of evidence, an appellate court ordered a retrial. That process began in January 2015. The three were again found guilty and, on August 29th, were sentenced to 3 years in prison. The United States is deeply disappointed and concerned by the verdict handed down by an Egyptian court to the three Al Jazeera journalists, Mohamed Fahmy, Bahar Mohamed, and Peter Grest, said State Department spokesperson John Kirby. The freedom of the press to investigate, report, and comment, even when its perspective is unpopular or disputed, is fundamental to any free society and essential to democratic development. We urge the government of Egypt to take all available measures to redress this verdict, which undermines the very freedom of expression necessary for stability and development. By finding these three men guilty, the government of Egypt has signaled that journalists can and will be prosecuted and imprisoned for simply doing their job of reporting the news. The Committee to Protect Journalists reports that as of July 1, 2015, at least 18 journalists are in prison for their reporting in Egypt. Even one is too many.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.